All right. Thank you, Stephen. So we're continuing our study in the book of Ecclesiastes, and the word Ecclesiastes could be translated in modern English to be the preacher. It's a word that describes is written by King Solomon, who God had blessed with an extreme amount of wisdom. And he was a very wealthy and very successful king, but he wasn't perfect and he wasn't omniscient. And we noticed some of that in later in his life. We'll talk more about that in future times. But when he wrote Ecclesiastes, he was writing it toward the end of his life. And you can tell that because of all the things he said he's already accomplished. And he says, he looks back at his life and he says, what really matters? You know, I tried to find meaning in life. I tried everything. And we've discussed that in the last three chapters that we've done. He tried everything. And nothing, he withheld nothing from himself to try to find what matters just here in life. And he said, it's all vanity. It's all empty or worthless or meaningless. It's like trying to grasp the wind. And that's really the theme that comes back again in chapter 4. In chapter 3, of course, he started out with that wonderful poem about that there's a time for every purpose under heaven and a time to plant and a time to reap and all those things. And we talked last week about how this was really his way of saying there's purpose in life. God has a purpose for every single thing he did. He didn't make anything at random or frivolously. God has a purpose in all his creation, and that means every breath we take and all of our lives has purpose in the plan of God. But finding out what God's purpose is beyond man, at least in detail. We know as Christians, because of God's word, we know what God's purpose for man is to be obedient and to have his sins forgiven and to live with God for eternity. We know that kind of at the high level, but knowing every single day, every little detail of what we need to do in our lives is beyond us, or what God has planned for us tomorrow or the next hour or even the next second of our lives is beyond us. So that whole idea that there was purpose in all of creation and all that God did, even if we can't figure it out, was a really important lesson from last time. And also that man has free will. He said, even though God has figured it out, God has determined everything and no one can change his plans, man at the end is going to be held accountable, which means God has given us choices to make and we're going to be accountable for those choices. So when we move into chapter 4, Solomon starts, and he actually says this phrase similarly in several places. He says, then I returned and considered. And so what we're going to have here are three or four little sections in chapter 4 where he's turning his gaze in trying to figure out what's important under the sun on particular things and talking about them. And you'll see some of these themes repeat from previous things he said. He expands on some of them, and there's some new thoughts here too. But they're all about the same notion of all the stuff that's happening in the world is vanity, because it doesn't have any ultimate profit in your life. When your life is over, what does this profit you? So we're going to read through the chapter, and then we'll dive into detail. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, he who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Again, I saw that for all the toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one, alone, without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This is also vanity and a great misfortune. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. again, the two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand it, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were there with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now, it's pretty clear from this reading that there are several kind of separate sections, but they all have this same, this is kind of a litany of things that he's gone and looked at. It's sort of like in the first chapter where he said, I went and tried this, and I went and tried that, and I went and tried that, and here was my results. Here he's giving us some different detailed accounts of some of the things he's observed. And one of the other things you might have noticed in here is the style starts sounding a lot like the book of Proverbs, which Solomon also wrote, where it has some short, wise sayings. And there's several of those in here as well. So let's go ahead and go back to the beginning. So they said, then I returned and looked at all the oppression that is done under the sun. So he says, oppression. What's oppression? This is where people are treating each other bad, right? Where people who are powerful are mistreating those who are weaker. And he says, look, the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors, there's power, but they have no comforter. And you're seeing this. This is something similar that he said earlier, back in chapter 3, verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. And, you know, this is kind of the same thought in a lot of ways, but here he's talking about oppression and the powerful. He's saying that there's evil in the world, and some people have a really rough time. And God allows oppressors to gain power, and he allows oppressors to oppress those who are being hurt here. That's things that God allows. It's just like God has allowed, because of free will, a man to decide to sin against his neighbor or to sin against God. You know, God gave us those abilities. And guess what? If somebody decides to sin against his neighbor and you're the neighbor, what happens? You're the one that's oppressed. You're the one that's gotten the bad done to them. And God has allowed that to happen because he's put us in a world of free will where we can choose. And the consequences of our choices are not only in our own lives. Very often they're in those around us, our neighbors, our family. Sometimes even for generations, those decisions have impact. So here first, he says, he's looking at this and saying it's a terrible situation. And then he says in verse 2, therefore, okay, what's it there for? Because he saw all the oppression and all the suffering. Therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Now, Solomon is not saying here that there's no value in life, right? We all just ought to die. He's not saying that at all. This is where you really have to keep it in context of what he says. He says, these people who are so terribly oppressed and are suffering so greatly, they have no rest. They have no peace. They have a miserable life. He said, the dead are better off than they are. You've heard that phrase before. You know, I wish I'd never been born, right? Or something like that, because it was such a terrible situation. This should ring some echoes for those of you who've been in the afternoon Bible readings that Stephen has had from the book of Job. We're going to go back and read a little of that just because I want you to get the depth of what Solomon's saying here. He's not talking about somebody just did them dirty, you know, and that's it. Job, of course, we know was suffering intensely at the hand of Satan that God had allowed, because God had, you know, Satan had said that Job would curse God and to his face if he took away God's blessings. And God said, I think I know Job, and I'll give you that ability for you to take away his riches and his family, and then to take away his health. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in the end of chapter 2 of Job. It says in verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took himself a potsherd from which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. His wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. This gives you a little bit of a hint for why Job says what he says in chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said a man-child is conceived. May the day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine on it. May darkness, the shadow of death, claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May blackness of day terrify it. For as for that night, may darkness seize it. May it not rejoice among the days of the year. May it not come into the number of the months. Oh, may that night be barren. May no shout of joy come from it. May those curse it and curse the day, those who are ready to arouse Leviathan. May the stars of its morning be dark. May it look for light but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes." That goes on. We're not going to read the rest of it. But there are many, many very serious, powerful passages in Scripture. This is one of them. And what you can really see here is just the anguish that Job is under right now, and the oppression that he's having because of all the curses, basically, that Satan's brought upon him to test him before God. And so when you hear this, what Solomon's saying back in Ecclesiastes, that there are these people who are oppressed and they're so stressed and so distressed that he says, man, they'd be better off if they'd never been born. It's like that. "Therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." Do you remember back in the very beginning of Ecclesiastes, there was one thing that he said there I'm going to go back to. Let me see here. I believe, yes. Right. Verse 18 of chapter 1, "For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow." See, Solomon even said there, he says, "I've gone out and looked over all the world, and what I've seen is a lot of sorrow and a lot of suffering." And here he says, man, people who haven't even lived, who haven't had to see all that evil in the world, are blessed. Now, again, he's doing this in the context of what's important in life. He's saying that sometimes there's so much oppression in life that it's just miserable, and that God allows people to oppress others. Verse 4. Again, he kind of shifts gears. "Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This is also vanity and a grasping for the wind." Now, he shifts gears here, and he goes back to talking about work and toil. And he said that several times already in Ecclesiastes. And what he keeps saying over and over is, what's good about it? If you go work really hard and you gain skill and wisdom and you do all kinds of things on the earth, what's the ultimate profit? Because when you're dead, all the things you've created are going to go to someone else. You know, but here he's talking about something a little different. He's saying, the toil and every skillful work, for that a man is envied by his neighbor. Now, he's not talking here about somebody looks over there and says, "Boy, Dan, you got a great yard, man. You guys have such great, just great skills out there with all the stuff you do. It's just such a nice thing to see." They're not talking about that. They're talking about covetousness, you know, where someone says, "Well, I don't know why he gets that kind of life. I don't get anything like that." You know, it's something like that. It's that kind of a feeling. And so he's saying that even though someone goes and works hard and works to gain wisdom and skill and accomplishes things, they're getting mistreated. They're getting oppressed by the people around them who covet what they have, covet their success. Then he kind of, this is a little section where he talks about how much you have and how much you need, and the difference between the worker. Because you might sit there and say, oh, I saw that all the toil and every scope of work of man is envied by his neighbor, and this is vanity. So, okay, great. I guess we don't need to work, right? We all just need to lay around. Notice what it says on the next verse. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. There's lots and lots of proverbs in the book of Proverbs that talk about the wise and the fool and compare them. And one of the things it says about the fool is the fool will just watch the sky. Instead of going out and planting, he'll say, well, you know, it just might rain tomorrow. I guess I shouldn't get out in the field today. And the next day he says, you know, it might snow tomorrow. I might not get out there. Oh, it's going to be too windy today. And he never plants and he never reaps and he starves because of it. And here he says, the fool folds his hands and in the process consumes his own flesh. He's destroying himself because of his laziness. And this is the very kind of person that envies the person who goes out and works hard and achieves and has food to eat and has a home to live in, that says, well, I don't think that's fair. When really the point is the person's not working. They're not going out and trying. And that, you know, you see the contrast between the person who was doing exactly what Solomon said. He said, it's good for man to go out and work hard. He said, don't work too hard because you need to enjoy the fruits of your labor. But going out and working hard and getting wisdom is all good, but people are going to envy you for it. And then he says, but the person on the other end is in a worse situation. But then verse 6, better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Now this is something that echoes through the scripture. And we had a little of this in our Thessalonians and Peter's classes. There's a verse in 1 Thessalonians 4:11, where he's instructing them to pray for those who are in authority, and he says that you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you. And then in 1 Timothy 2, verse 2, this is another thing, praying for kings and all who are authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. And then in 1 Peter 3, verse 4, he's talking about women in particular. He says, you know, don't be adorned, basically, in the previous verses, basically don't be adorned with costly apparel and all those things, but rather let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. In all of these three, and really, along with what he says here in verse 6, in verse 6 in Ecclesiastes, is peace, a peaceful life, a quiet and peaceful life, is a high goal. In the New Testament, we're taught to seek that. We're taught to pray that the kings of those in authority allow us to live a quiet and peaceful life. And I know for one, there have been times in my life when I have not had a peaceful life or a peaceful home. And that's just terrible. I'm very blessed now to have a very peaceful home, and it's a wonderful blessing. I pray about it and thank God about it all the time. And many of you listening, you know what it's like. You know what it's like to have a peaceful home. You know what it's like not to. But in this, notice what he says. What's the cause of some of this? It's not the cause for everything. Sometimes it's because you're in a situation you can't help, just like the oppressor up there. There's bad stuff going on, and you're just the one that's feeling the brunt of it. But in verse 6, notice what he says. Right after talking about the one who works and the one who doesn't, better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Now there's a hint, because he's saying the grasping for the wind, that's the one that's out there working themselves silly, you know, trying to get more and more and more when they already have enough. And you know, that's where you have workaholics, right? People who go out and work and work and work, and all they do is want to work more and gain more and work more and gain more. And at the end of their life, they look back, and what do they have? Well, they had the corner office in the big building. They had the fancy title. They had a lot of money in the bank. They had a miserable life, and it's over. You know, that's what they end up with. So the question for you is, how much is one handful? Notice what he says. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. I think that's one of those decisions we have to make for ourselves. But you know what it's talking about here? One thing for sure, one handful is half of two handfuls, right? So is that, you know, having lots and lots and lots of stuff and lots of extra? You know, I think Stephen mentioned this in one of his lessons the other day about the man who you know, he had his barn full and he God had blessed him with great crops. And he says, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger barns, and I'll just fill it with more stuff that God's blessed me with. That's the fool. God says to him that night, thou fool, this night your soul will be required of you, and who will get that which you've stored up? He had more than two hands full. One handful with quietness. That is a great goal for a Christian. Do you, you know, Paul even talks about this. He says, do you have food to eat and clothes to wear? Then be content. Be content. And he says that to soldiers too. He says, be content with your wages. You know? If you have enough to support yourself and your family, be content. Be happy that you can live quiet and peaceable. You know, I had a long career at IBM, and about 20 almost 25 years there. And I was an executive at IBM, and you know, it was a very stressful job. I enjoyed it. It was a great blessing in my life. But I was under a lot of stress. I had to travel a lot, and I was really, really wore out a lot and really stressed out a lot. And I know there's a cost. I can definitely tell you there's a cost for going for the two hands full. And I paid it for years and years. And I had a friend of mine who's a colleague at IBM call me last night. She's a very smart, very talented woman, colleague of mine. And she was considering taking a job with a different company and was asking my advice. And she said, you know, I'm thinking about maybe starting a company. And, you know, it's really great. And you'd be great. You ought to come work with me. And I'm sitting there going like, no way. I am so thankful that God has blessed me the way he's blessed me now. And sure, I could go out and start a company and I could probably make $1 million. I could make a bunch. You know, I know how to be successful. But the peace and quiet in my own home and where God has placed me here with Sarah, here in the mountains, here in Rutherfordton with y'all is so precious. And learning that lesson, that kind of family and home and peace is worth way, way more than what you can get by working that extra job. And you know, what does he say? It's a grasping for the wind. So let's continue. Verse 7. Then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. So here he's going to talk to us about a different subject, right? There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. He never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. And he's talking about someone who's working really hard. This is a workaholic again. It's kind of similar. But notice what he focuses on. One without a companion, no son, no brother. He's trying to do it all himself. He's so focused on wealth and success that he's not even building relationships with people. And there are definitely people like that in the world. I used to work for some of them. I know some personally. And notice what he says. For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? He doesn't have anyone to give it to. He doesn't have anyone to share it with. And he's never satisfied. No matter how hard he works, there's always more to earn. So this is meaningless. It's a vanity and a grave misfortune. It's terrible. Why? Because he's wasting his life. He's working himself to the bone. You know, that phrase is one of those that's a great one to think about here. You know, there's an old mountain song that says, work your fingers to the bone, and what do you get? Bony fingers. And that's really the case here. He says, no matter how hard he worked, what has he got at the end? It's vanity. Then he kind of shifts gears, and he talks about, he contrasts the one who is working without a companion with people who have companions. So verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. You know, for everybody who's ever worked at a job where you had to work with a team and work with companions, you know, this is true. You can accomplish so much more together, working together, especially taking advantage of each other's strengths and also helping to cover for each other's weaknesses. And that's a great thing about teamwork and about relationships that we build, whether it's at work or in families or in marriage or anything like that. Because if one of you fall, the other one is there to pick you up. You know, like we say, got your back, you know, got you covered. That's a great comfort, and it makes a huge difference in your ability to enjoy life. Because you know that even if there's a hard time, you're not going to be alone. You've got someone there with you. Then he says here in verse 11, again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Now, there's kind of two aspects to this. You know, one of these is naturally kind of talking about the relationship with your spouse, right? There's a natural thing there about the comfort and togetherness that happens with between a man and a wife. But you know, just the physics of it. You know, if you're out in the Arctic and you're by yourself, all you got is your own body heat. But if you have someone there that you can share your body heat with, you both have a much stronger likelihood of survival. And it's a little funny when you think about it, because you're all feeling just as cold. You got just as much cold on the outside, but because you're able to share your warmth, you're able to survive. And so there's this aspect in here about sharing not just warmth, but life together. You know, sharing those strengths, holding each other up. Verse 12 kind of continues. He says, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So here he contrasts one versus two versus three. Okay? So one person by themselves, if they run into someone stronger than them, they're in trouble. But two, even if they're each individually weaker than the one who's oppressing them, they can stand together and they can withstand the attack. When he says a threefold cord, you may not think about that very much, but when was the last time you looked at a rope? You know, if you look at an old hemp rope or a jute rope that's made out of plant fibers, guess what? There's three strands in it. And the reason is that if you twist three strands together, it's way stronger than if you just twist two strands together. And so when he says a threefold cord is not quickly broken, in this context, he's not talking about rope. He's talking about the relationships, family and friends. If you have good, strong relationships around you, you're going to be able to withstand the oppression. You're going to be able to withstand the hard times. There's an aspect of this and something else that Solomon wrote, Psalm 127. It says, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain to build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, and to eat the bread of sorrows. For so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, the children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They will not be ashamed, but they shall speak with their enemies at the gate. There's two pieces here that you can tell. This is very much the same kind of line of thinking that Solomon writes in Ecclesiastes. First, he says, it is vain for you to rise up early and sit up late and to eat the bread of sorrows. He said, you know, that's the workaholic. That's exactly what they do. And he says, for he giveth his beloved sleep. Sleep is a blessing from God. And for those of us that have had trouble sleeping or may have trouble sleeping now, you understand what a precious blessing it is just to get a good night's sleep. But the last three verses are the ones that I wanted to bring in here. We talked about a threefold cord and talking about friends and family. Children are a heritage of the Lord. And then he says, happy is the man that has a full quiver of his children. He has lots of children. So they shall not be ashamed, even when they confront their enemies at the gate. And that's that same idea of that friends and family and strong relationships can help build us up and help bring us through difficult times. The last section of chapter 4 starts in verse 13, and it's a really different thought yet again. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more, for he comes out of prison to be king, and although he was born in his he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun, and they were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now, there's some of this is more proverbial in the sense that it's not talking about anyone specifically. It's talking about a pattern. But there's also some other aspect to it I'll mention in a minute. So it says, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king And then he says, for he comes out of prison to be king. He's talking about this person who became king. He started out poor, but he became king. Everybody followed him. It was great. There was no end to all the people who he was over when he was made king. But then there was another youth, and everybody said, oh, let's go follow him. And pretty soon, no one's going to rejoice in him. This is that kind of new kid in town syndrome, you know, that you hear about sometimes. He's talking about a man who becomes king and is a great leader and has power and a following, and everybody wants to be next to him, and everybody wants to be with him, and everybody follows him. It's very much like the celebrities today, whether they're entertainment stars or sports stars or politicians or something like that. But then he says, but then the next one comes along and he's forgotten. You know, there is a fickleness to fame, and the followings, you know, can come and they can go. And that kind of power, the power of celebrity, is something that's vain. He says, this is a vanity and a grasping for the wind. But there's one other aspect of this I wanted to touch before we finish. This verse here, 13, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. This always struck me as almost an echo of Solomon talking about himself. Now, he wasn't a poor and wise youth. He was wise, but he wasn't poor. He was very wealthy. So it's not a complete fit. But he says he could have said better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king, or just an old king. Yeah, and he would have made his point with the rest of the verses that celebrity was vain, and that kind of following and power based on the following can vanish away. But here it says, that an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. And when you think of Solomon at the end of his life, when he's looking back over all his years of success, and then looking back at his own failings, his own sin, you know, the scriptures tell us that Solomon was a very wise man. God blessed him to be the wisest man of his age. But then it says he went out and had many wives. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And it says, and his wives turned his heart from the Lord. And before long, because they were all from foreign countries, and they worshiped foreign gods, they worshiped idols. And before long, the scriptures tell us in the Kings and Chronicles, Solomon was building idols, temples for his wives to worship at all around Jerusalem. And eventually God brought him to task for that and said, I've spoken to you twice and look what you're doing. And so there's a little bit of an echo here of Solomon kind of thinking about himself here, I think. It's my supposition, so it's speculation. But the notion that he looks back and he says, boy, I was foolish. Look at the things, and I got to where I wouldn't listen to anybody anymore. No matter what people said, I thought I was so wise. But look where I've come to. And Solomon, at the end of his life, when he wrote this, he was faithful to God. And we'll see that all the way through the end. But he had already gone through a lot of sin in his life and had borne the punishment for it. And in fact, God had told him that because of that sin, he was going to take away, he was going to divide the kingdom of Israel when Rehoboam, his son, became king. And that's what happened. So there was a lot of tragedy and a lot of sorrow that happened because of Solomon's lack of faithfulness to God, no matter how wise he was. And that should be a warning for us, really. You know, there's that wonderful verse that says, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. And no matter how old or how wise or how educated we think we are, we should always be on the lookout for sin, because it's always sitting there crouching like a lion waiting to devour us. So I'll go ahead and stop there, and we'll go on over to Dan's lesson.